Last week on the show, I talked a little bit about, it'll be two weeks ago, that I talked about the bird language and the book and some of the alarms in nature. And it was interesting. John visited the Bushman this year and with a special focus on bird language. And he said that he'd always thought the, you know, it'd be the men hunters that would be really tuned into it. And they said, oh, no, we don't do that stuff. And then proceeded to tell him a bunch of bird language stuff. But it wasn't the men who were really so tuned into it. It was the women and children who were off, you know, foraging, hunting, doing the gathering part of the hunter-gatherer thing by themselves, small kids and elders. And they didn't have, you know, they didn't have the weapons to fight back against the lions and leopards and things that could attack them. So they were, their best defense was, you know, early detection. And so they were super tuned into bird language. And so the hunters, the bird language they knew was stuff that they knew from being children with the women. And so I don't know, you know, in, I don't know if John has specific questions, that he'd like to ask you. I know you have, some stuff you wanted to talk, or you can talk about the, understanding of birds in Koyukon, tradition and culture. And I'm not sure, you know, whether you're aware of anything about, you know, bird language per se, in terms of interpreting what the birds are doing to make inferences about other animals and things like that.
Well, there's a number of things to say about that. My curiosity has really piqued about John's experience with San or Bushman people in Africa. And, you know, I'm interested in the whole, the reciprocity, the language that goes back and forth between people and birds. And some of it is pretty straightforward, like the yellow legs, the lesser yellow legs up in the interior of Alaska where Koyukon people live, is a bird that, you know, from a practical standpoint, it signals what's going on around. So when you hear a yellow legs talking on and on and on with a call that Koyukon people represent as saying, siyit, 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 and they'll do this endlessly and drive you absolutely mad when they're doing it at you. It's a warning call, but it also lets you know if there's another animal around because they jump up off their nest and make that sound. And so to a certain extent, it's a practical thing that you hear this call and you know that maybe there's something else around that, that has the yellow legs upset. But also Koyukon people say that siyits means my breath. So it's saying my breath, my breath, my breath, my breath. And you can yell back at it. You can say siyits. And if it keeps doing that for a long time, it's telling you that you're going to have a long life. And if it stops fairly quickly, it means you're going to have a short life. And one of the people who told me this said, I don't know why anybody would want to ask. I don't want to know that, one of my Koyukon teachers said. So that's just a nice example of the reciprocal language going back and forth between people and birds. So that's my story. Now I'm curious to know about another part of the world.
Yeah, John, and I'll just say here from the book, John has stories about his family, even his was it your great grandmother or great aunt
It was my great grandmother in Poland, while in Poland, developed a unique relationship with birds, or maybe not unique for that rural part of Poland, but when she got to the U.S., she would recite a little prayer in Polish or a little poem and tap her hand to her finger to her palm, and an American robin would come over and touch its beak to her fingertip. And that was a lot of people saw that in our family. And so my great aunt, her daughter, her oldest daughter, also born in Poland, kind of carried on with that and talked about this reciprocal language with birds and, you know, what the birds brought. So, you know, rich in my family. I have not researched it in the rural Polish countryside, but sure, I definitely long to do that at some point in my life, even while chasing my ancestry back a little bit, too, in the land where they're from. But in the Kalahari, I was with people who speak the Naro language, and there was multiple language groups that had converged, kind of, I'm going to call them refugees from the settlement era. They're people who realize that settlements don't always work for Bushmen, and they've very intentionally chosen to live in an old semi-permanent village that as long as anybody from, there's a family that's been there six generations, about 130 years now, farming in that part of Botswana near Hunsi, near the Namibian border, central Kalahari, and in what you would call a farmland district bordering no man's land, otherwise known as Bushman land in the local region. And in this place, there's a lot of Bushmen who have seen super negative impacts from settlement communities on, along the pavement that the government set up for them. And many of them have chosen to be part of this, you know, semi-wild existence, semi-dependency on cattle posts and, as a last resort, settlements. So they still are nomadic, if you will, and they're moving back and forth between this village called Rooibrak, which is 3.5 hours from pavement, probably, or maybe 3 hours from pavement. That's the semi-permanent village that they've occupied as long as anyone can remember. The, you know, people who've been there 130 years found them there, and, you know, they were wild then. So that family line has been, or I guess it's about five or six family lines, has been pretty well tied in with the farmers right there. They've known each other for six generations, and the farmers all speak their language, the Naro language, fluently. So the unusual thing about this particular farmer is that he lets the Bushmen work on his cattle posts and bring their whole family along. So if a father is working on the settlement, all his children will be there, as well as his wife, maybe his mother-in-law, maybe his brother and his brother's wife, and he'll just let them all just live there because they still gather most of their food from the Kalahari there. Their oral tradition remembers that place only, really. They don't have much memory in that particular community of any other place. They know certain plants that are growing in that region that do not have botanical names or are not identified by Western botanists anywhere yet. And so you can sort of think of them as sort of a hybrid Bushman community. Some of them choose to send their kids to school. They put them on trucks and take them away to the school for Monday to Friday over in Hunsi, and then the kids come back to the cattle post and they get distributed back to their families from there. And there's mixed stories. I mean, there's at least five language groups that have gathered in this, what they're calling themselves, Masaro. The Naro language is the language they have in common, but they call themselves Masaro, and I guess that means to them mixed background, all speaking Naro. So some interesting stories there. They're not totally cohesive because, you know, each little family group from a different language group also has different understandings of cultural subtlety. So at times they're a little bit chaotic, but a lot of times they're also very unified. What's brought them together is a collective need for safety from negative influences of the settlement experience. So there's varying degrees of traditional ecological knowledge present in the people. Obviously, the older they are, the more likely you are to get tremendous traditional ecological knowledge, and there's a mixed sense of whether or not young people want to learn the traditional ecological knowledge, and so you have kind of a mix of that, but there's some young people who are super interested in it and are really carrying it on and really joining their parents and their grandparents to keep the knowledge alive. So it's a great place to go and spend time wandering and foraging on the land with them for the various plant foods and working with them on their trap. They set traps for various things, and birds and mammals and small mammals. So I had the opportunity to spend 2 weeks with them, and I was zeroing in on the question of bird language for 2 weeks as I wandered around with them. And I've been visiting the same community for 3 years now. And what I learned this year was really eye-opening for me because I, you know, my mentor, Tom Brown Jr., claims that his mentor was an Apache elder and never really got to know this family or the people who mentored him as a boy, but I knew Tom since he was 21 and his brother was about 18. So So I grew up the street from that family and really got to know the family story. So I knew there was somebody in his life, and the family verifies that somebody existed. And Tom's skills and ability as a tracker and as a person who understands bird language intimately, really is a testament to some powerful mentoring that he received as a boy. And he deliberately told me that he would never tell me exactly who his mentor was, and he told me that he wasn't from the tribe that he describes in his books because he was trying to protect the innocent. So from notoriety. And I did my own research and did a lot of digging and found a lot of examples of Apaches who survived the Apache War period and who actually got to live on as free individuals off the reservations and did carry on traditional knowledge. Some of them to this day are undocumented, and they won't get passports, they won't get birth certificates, they won't get driver's licenses because they don't want to acknowledge surrender. So, it's very possible one of the tribes in and around the Western Apache communities did indeed generate an elder who did go to New Jersey and did work with my mentor from boyhood. But, he pretty much straight up told me that I'm not going to tell you exactly the names or the circumstances, and I'm going to change the datelines and everything just because I've been asked to protect the anonymity of some people. So, therefore, when he's ready to retire, he'll tell me. But in the meantime, it's a mystery, and it has been for a long time. It's driven a lot of my research into anthropology, for one thing, to understand the process by which traditional ecological knowledge moves between generations in a potent way. The postmodern world is highly lacking in connection and understanding and needless to say, traditional ecological knowledge, and most people are so disconnected from their ancestral lands and their ancestral patterns, they don't even understand the concept of traditional ecological knowledge or even what it offers in its full potency, because it isn't just about information or skill. I think it's also about a kind of spiritual well-being that people can possess, but most modern people don't even know is possible. So my career has been dedicated to understanding the subtleties and how those processes pass on effectively between generations among hunter-gatherer nomadic people who come from sandy places, because I was very interested in the language of tracking, not just the practice of tracking, wildlife tracking, or what I would rather call indigenous holistic tracking, as opposed to what tracking is being defined as today by people who do nature inventories for data collection purposes. There's so much richness to tracking as a tradition in places where they can see a lot and describe a lot in the sand. And the Bushmen are certainly exceptional as trackers, and they are still respected that way today. And the people that I'm working with in Western Botswana are extraordinary trackers, but they don't even know what they know. It's amazing to be with them. They're able to interpret virtually every mark on the ground with a lot of information, as well as feeling. They're able to imitate and show me how things move, and talk to me about the difference between males and females, and young and old, and moods of the animals, and all that kind of stuff. So, even though they're not fully indigenous in the way that they used to be, they certainly still possess a lot of that power. So I studied sandy places because the Apaches definitely had a tracking culture like that in their heyday, and I wanted to understand how tracking knowledge passed between generations, to understand the process that Tom may have experienced as a boy, consciously or unconsciously, that he then passed on to me unconsciously. Because I was, as Matt said, completely amazed when I got to Natural History University studies, discovering that I knew things that I wasn't actually able to know. Like, nobody else knew them, my professors didn't know them, and when I sort of offered knowledge humbly and sort of innocently, I was often challenged in a really intense way and told that that was impossible, that you couldn't know that. So I was really kind of surprised by that. And What the Robin Knows is kind of a celebration of the merger of that traditional knowledge of bird language as taught to me in a very holistic mentoring kind of way, starting with my great aunt and my great grandmother, and then moving into my mentoring with Tom Brown from the age of 10 till about the age of 19 when he 18 when he opened his school. I was working there when I was 19. That was 1978-79 when he opened his school. So I became fascinated. You know, how could traditional knowledge pass invisibly to a suburban boy in New Jersey, being me, you know, and wondering how could I have learned so much and not even known that I was learning it. And I investigated this whole science in my anthropology career at Rutgers University, which wasn't really to become an anthropologist, but I sort of minored in anthropology at Rutgers. I took every course I could get my hands on and wrote a lot of papers and did a lot of research on traditional mentoring methodologies. And I sort of coined this idea of coyote mentoring, you know, the trickster transformer approach to mentoring, bringing people to places without their knowledge that they're going someplace. Which is definitely necessary in every generation of people who possess traditional ecological knowledge, because you're born with potential for it, but your culture brings you to it, and it brings you to it in a very rich array of methods and systems that people, I find, even when I find really skilled mentors within traditional knowledge communities, they often don't even know that they have a process that's really effective. So, you know, that's a quick introduction, you know, to me, if you will. I could go into a little bit of what I discovered as far as what the Bushmen know, but just, you know, wondered, Richard, I didn't want to sort of dominate the conversation. I thought I would, you know, let you hear that a little bit and get a sense of who I am, where I come from, to some degree, that might help us shape this conversation in a way that would really benefit us and people who are listening to us.
Yeah, thanks. It's a very different background than my own, I guess. Mine is probably simpler and more being a curious student of Native people here in Alaska, and being privileged to live in indigenous communities here for a number of years and learn from people, and particularly Koyukon people who have such an incredibly rich tradition of personal and spiritual and economic connection with the natural world. It certainly revolutionized my entire sense of what nature is, coming from a very probably a similar background to your own, growing up in the Midwest. The whole idea that there's a lot more to nature than we learn in Western society, that we're sort of taught half of what exists. I've always thought of it as not seeing the backside of the mirror, not seeing the whole world that lives behind these creatures that we share the world with. So for Koyukon people, every animal is both a physical thing and a spiritual thing. And a lot of their interactions with animals are of a spiritual and moral and ethical sort. And that whole conversation, the idea of living in conversation with the natural world, is so fundamental to their being that I suppose people don't really even think about it or conceptualize it in the abstract. It's simply the way things are. So the idea, like with the yellow legs, of the yellow legs telling you things and of you speaking to the yellow legs, is something that carries through many, many other animals. When you talked about the title, when I heard the title of your book and saw your book, Koyukon people say that the robin's song is a, you know, they put words to it as they do with many birds. So the robin is saying, the American robin is saying, "Dodo, silin, which is that I've never understood why it's saying what it is. It's saying, "Down there, my brother-in-law slurps up pike guts." And nobody ever explained why it says that. But the interesting thing is that nowadays, robin songs are changing quite rapidly. And I've certainly heard it in my lifetime. And Koyukon people who I've spoken with, elders, are really upset about it, that something is really amiss with the world because robins don't talk right anymore. And so the songs are attenuated and strange and just not what they're accustomed to. So the conversation is also dynamic and changing.
Yep, changing and evolving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As I think, it's probably always been that way. I'm sure nature has. It's been changing faster lately than it ever has, or at least, you know, in the lifetime or the memory of people. But I think it always has always changed. And I wonder how culture adapts to that change, and I guess we won't really know because we're always alive when we are, and we see what we see.
Yeah, I think Koyukon people are. I think that changing of the conversation makes them feel that something is deeply amiss with the world. You know, something is really wrong, and so here are people who are constantly getting sort of messages from the earth, and what they do with it. I guess, as you say. We can't know that right now. I think the key, and I really agree strongly with you about the importance of people becoming aware of this kind of knowledge of the world, the key to my way of thinking is to keep that knowledge alive. Because mm-hmm. where do we go if we don't have that knowledge? I remember a young Koyukon man saying to me many, many years ago, probably 40 years ago, saying, "You're smart but not wise." And I've always thought it was one of the most important. He was young, he was a teenager. I thought it was one of the most important things I've ever heard, because I interpreted it to mean you being me as a member of my culture. I belong to a very smart culture, but perhaps not a very wise one.
Yeah, that's a great summary, isn't it?
Yeah.
That will stay with me too. I mean, that's haunting, and in a good way.
It is, absolutely. I was struck by the fact that a young guy said, I was young too, I was in my 20s, and I was always struck that a young man said something that's so inherently wise, and I never heard it from anybody else. I suspect, you know, maybe he heard that from his grandfather or something. I think he also meant that I was just not a very bright guy, or not a very wise guy. More of a wise guy than a wise guy.
Yep. Yeah, I get it. I think I have a little of that in me. Wow, great.
But
the story of the yellow legs is really bringing to me the story of the crowned plover in western Botswana. I mean, here where I'm from, actually, in New Jersey, it would have been the killdeer kind of playing the job of the yellow legs. We also had yellow legs, but they weren't as common as the killdeer. But the killdeer often told me when coyote or fox is on the move. I usually had to go and look to see, because I couldn't tell the difference. I just knew it was a ground predator, and I knew that it was moving in a route where I saw both coyote and fox tracks all the time. And, you know, so I have personal experience knowing that that incessant call of a member of that greater family of things that run along the edge of the water there, the sandpipers and the plovers. And in Botswana, I was out with a couple of men from the United States and several Bushmen men from multiple generations. There was an elder who, he doesn't know how old he is because he doesn't know when he was born. But people suspect that he may be somewhere in his 80s. It's also hard to tell because they're very vital and healthy in their old age, these guys. But this man was initiated as a hunter in his tribe, and has initiated his sons in a way that's illegal according to the Botswana government. But he also knew that he had to initiate his sons because, you know, in a way, their well-being, their health, their mental health, their spiritual health was tied up with whether or not he initiated them. And so he took it upon himself to initiate them, even though it was illegal for them to hunt in the way that they were on the land which they were on. But he was also smart enough to know that he never saw any footprints from anybody but himself and his family, so he just did it. And then also within that group was a man in his 50s somewhere, and the farming family had known him since boyhood, so they knew roughly that he was in his 50s, probably late 50s, and he's an extraordinary tracker and an amazing man in terms of his character, his conduct. He's just incredibly fun and funny and a real leader and he's an inspiration to his own little group. He lifts people's spirits and keeps them excited about learning their old ways. And yeah, he's a fantastic guy to spend time with. And then his younger brother, who's considered the best hunter now in the village, and that guy's probably in his late 40s. And then that man's son, who's 26. And so we were out there with those guys just kind of poking around, and they would show us a trapping technique, and we would show them a trapping technique. The three guys that were together from my group were all primitive skills practitioners from different parts of the U.S. and had different levels of training. So we were just trading licks with them, basically, and it was a lot of fun, you know, and showing them how we make fire. They showed us how they made fire, and we were talking about the rite of passage and the initiation of the hunt, and I thought, okay, here's a great opportunity to introduce the concept of bird language as something that I'm really interested in and want to, you know, get their perspective on. And so the translator worked through what I was saying, they said, well, we don't actually know bird language. And I knew, of course, that was I must have really been misinterpreted, because there's no way they didn't know bird language. You couldn't possibly be a bushman and not know bird language, you know. So after a while, they immediately started telling me stories. And within, I don't know, probably the next 2 hours in our walk, that was punctuated by stopping and making a fire and playing with some things, they proceeded to lay out 8 really strong principles of bird language that I've found in every other place where I've ever talked to indigenous people. So this is the stuff that people know. And they told me, you know, the crown plover tells them when the lion is on the move, when they're out hunting, or when they're with their families in their village. At night, they keep one ear open while they're sleeping for the crown plover call, because if the crown plovers make a certain sound at night, they know the lions are moving, and they know exactly where the lions are. And they said sometimes it's a leopard, but it's almost always lions when it makes this sound. And then they proceeded to tell me that the blacksmith plover makes this sound for lions. And then they said, oh, and during the day, the pied babbler makes this sound. And they didn't know the English names, and certainly the translator didn't know the English names for these birds. But I was with them for 2 weeks, and so when I saw a bird or heard a bird that sounded similar to the ones they were describing, then I would say, is this the one you were telling me about for the lions? You know, so that's how I figured out, you know, reverse engineered what they told me. And when we encountered blacksmith plovers and crown plovers when we were together, they verified that those were the birds they were talking about for the night sounds, and that the babbler was the one for the day sounds. And then I discovered that they weren't really aware that an accipiter was on the move. And here in the States, where I teach bird language a lot, the easiest way to prove to your average American, even a birder, that bird language works and that you can interpret it effectively is to have a Cooper's hawk move through while you're there, and then to explain to them the concentric ring of a Cooper's hawk that's hunting and how songbirds feel about it when a Cooper's hawk's on the wing, and how sort of basic it is to read that. And once people get it, they're like, oh, yeah, you're right, that does work. So I was exploring the knowledge of these bushmen around accipiters on the wing that were hunting. And we had 2 accipiters basically following us as we were moving around the landscape that day. And I guess they're probably taking advantage of the fact that we're kicking out stuff and making stuff run away and, you know, scaring things. And so if a bunch of wildebeest suddenly start charging and running, I think it creates a little, you know, burst of songbirds that suddenly fly in a chaotic way, and the accipiters take advantage of that moment of chaos, and like dolphins off the bow of a ship. And the principle is called wake hunting. And there was actually literally 2 species of occipiters that seemed to weave together. The whole time I was there for those 2 weeks, I was studying bird language. I was aware of a species called the shikra, which is slightly larger and a little darker than the little sparrowhawk, both of which are in between the size of a Cooper's hawk and a sharp-shinned hawk. And they worked off of each other's wake. So I saw the shikra use the little sparrowhawk's wake, and I saw the little sparrowhawk following the shikra. And there was a water hole where the Burchell sand grouse came by the thousands each morning, always right around 9 a.m. They started to gather in the sky, then they'd all come land down there. And, of course, that was like a salmon run for bears, so lots of raptors would show up, and these two occipiters would show up. But in the heat of the day, late morning, when we were out moving around with the Bushmen hunters, those occipiters would follow us, which I found really interesting. And I'm convinced it's because we were bound to be spooking the wildebeest or the eland or whatever we bumped into. So there's all this kind of chain reaction stuff going on that the occipiters were taking advantage of, and you could easily see what the occipiters were causing in the language of the small birds that were around. And when I pointed it out to the Bushmen, they were completely unaware of it. And when I explained it to them, they really understood it immediately and agreed, and then were aware of it for the rest of the time we were together, but they assured me that they didn't know that before I showed it to them. And I found that interesting. You know, that was, the man that I was with. And then we also got to talk to them quite a bit about their self-defense against the African lion when they're out hunting. And they pretty much told us, I got from their stories that pretty much the men, when they're out moving about and hunting, and they have a spear or two with them, and they've got their poison-tipped arrows, and, they're not really well-armed. You know, if a pride of lions decided to attack or something, they'd definitely be in trouble. But their best offense, against the lion is the same thing the lion uses against them, which is essentially a mock charge. So the Bushmen just show extraordinary confidence and just charge at the lions and brandish their spears, but don't ever do anything with them. And the lions, according to them, always run away. So I began to recognize that, in a certain sense, the Bushmen men are not so concerned about an early warning. They're aware of where a leopard is. They're aware of where poisonous snakes are, all from bird language. And they were even aware of where a mongoose was, which I found interesting because the mongoose is not, sort of directly a threat to them, but they really knew mongoose movements from bird language. But I found it interesting that they didn't know the occipiters, which were seemingly following them. So I began to realize that what happens with the Bushmen men when they're on the move is that they're on the move. You know, they walk fast, they walk single file, and when they have to defend themselves, they make false charges, and then they just keep moving. They don't think twice about it. They just keep going on to take care of business. And for that reason, I don't think they really care too much about what kind of concentric ring they're causing. There's so much game there that they don't have to worry about scaring something away, per se, and they can track it and follow it as far as they want to. So they're very good at stalking. And we always got really close to animals when we wanted to with them. I mean, really close, surprisingly close. And I was impressed with their ability to camouflage and move invisibly when they wanted to. So I scratched my head a little bit about the occipiter thing, and then I went out with the women. And I was out with the women in the evening when the sun was going low, and I stayed with them until the sun touched the earth, and then we went back to our camp. And we went to the little shelter buildings where we were staying, and they went back to their little camp. And when we were with the women, it suddenly really dawned on me that the real subtle knowledge of bird language was with the women. And it, for the reasons that Matt explained early, there was 19 children, and there was 5 mothers, there was great aunties and grandmothers, and there was a couple of really old men. And we were out there together. And I saw pretty quickly, and I asked, quite a few questions, a lot of different ways, and from what I gather, this is how they gather. They don't really have the protection of men while they're out gathering. The men are often hunting or back at the village. And that when we're out with the women, when they see a lion track, fresh lion track, they quickly clump together in a group. They just come right together, and they all call out to each other, and they all show up within within less than a minute. They're all really tightly grouped, and then they just get out of there completely. They just go in the opposite direction of the lion, and they go really far away, and then they start foraging again. So they also knew about the crown plover, and they knew about the babblers, and they knew about the blacksmith plover, and they were really aware of a lot of other subtlety. And I began to sense what that was about, because when they were gathering medicines or roots or marumba beans or whatever they were gathering, they spread out away from each other. They stayed within eye contact of each other. They always knew where each other was. The children would sit in the shadows of the bushes in and around where they were gathering if they were not in the mood to gather, and they would play quiet games. But you would hardly know there was 19 children with you out there in the bush when you were with them, because you only rarely heard a sound that indicated there was a child nearby. And while on the Predator Project there, we had an American 3-year-old with us, and he whined for his mother, and the moment he whined, the lioness got up from her daybed and came stalking over to get a better look. And I began to realize, that these kids grow up from an early age knowing that whining, crying, complaining, yelling, screaming, all this was really not to their advantage. And not because their moms and dads were driven crazy by it, but because it was calling in the one thing that nobody wanted to come close to them. And that was the lions, and, also hyenas. And, we can list down all the things that could easily take a bushman child. And so in talking to the mothers, I began to realize that the mothers were the ones with subtle knowledge of all things bird language, and they were constantly listening to bird language, and they were constantly tuning into the movements of things, and they were able to distinguish easily between aerial predators and ground predators, and they basically listened to everything that was happening at all times and had quick discussions among themselves and essentially then moved on to foraging if they established that it was a hawk or a mongoose and not a lion. So I found that really interesting, and it also kind of pointed to me, watching the children watch the mothers, I saw that the children were like a deer herd or an impala herd, in that when bird language did go off in one direction or another, all their heads turned simultaneously, and they took cues off each other. So if a little kid saw a bigger kid's head turn and that older kid was looking sharply in one direction, he would look there too. And I watched this beautiful rendering of how this stuff passes through time, through these children and through these mothers, and of course through the fathers too. But, that was... a little insight into the knowledge of bird language in and among the San people that I was with there in Western Botswana.
It's interesting. It's such a dramatic difference between what you describe for Africa and how life is here in Alaska, where we have some big animals here, like bears, but they're so much more subtle and so much more skittish. People carry around a lot of fear of bears, but I don't know. Maybe you feel the same way, Matt. For me, as an Alaskan, I think, whoa, what a different world it is when you have such a bold social animal like lions around compared to the way it is here.
Yeah, I don't find myself being overly concerned about bears here. I've heard that the interior bears are a little more aggressive, probably because there's less easy food for them.
Interior grizzlies.
Grizzlies. Yeah, mm-hmm. And actually, that's one of the things I'm a little curious about. I remember John, when telling the story of the Bushman in another context where I heard it, mentioned the agreement that they have with the lions, that the lions get, if I'm remembering this correctly, the lions have the watering holes at night and the bushmen have it during the day. And that's an understood, agreement between species. And John can sort of fill in the details for that if I'm misremembering, but I'm curious if there are those sort of, back to the idea of this reciprocity between people and the natural world in which they live. I'm wondering if that's also something that happens in Koyukon culture and understanding.
Well, it does in a very big, very complex way, in that, Koyukon people hunt black bears for food, but the black bear isn't an animal that people in the interior, indigenous people in interior Alaska, seem to concern themselves about as a danger. Not that I've ever heard. In fact, a Gwich'in man once told me that a black bear, well, he's just like a dog. You know, you don't worry about him. But the grizzly bear, as you suggest, is more formidable and people worry more about them. But for Koyukon people, your relationship to the black bear, if I understand correctly, it's something that's far more complex than I would ever understand. But it's predicated on your whole life history of the respect you've shown toward the animal. And so if you have been scrupulously respectful to these animals through your life, you have much less to worry about. If you've been disrespectful, which includes the way you talk about them, includes being, you know, bragging that such and such could never hurt you, includes even using the proper name of the animal as opposed to a circumlocution like big animal or brown thing, all those things can create danger for you. So it's all about respect to the animal. And I do remember learning from an elder here in Southeast Alaska, a Tlingit elder, no longer living in Sitka, who told me about, as a young man, he learned from the elders that you make an agreement with the bears. I won't hurt you if you don't harm me. And he told me that he'd lived his whole life following what he had promised and that no brown bear had ever bothered him. And then there's also the same man, and I've heard it from a number of other Tlingit people here. It's not my position really to speak of it, but I hope I'll be forgiven for that. I heard people say that on going into the woods somewhere, going up a stream or something, to say, forgive me, my grandfather, for trespassing on your land. I'm only here trying to make my living the same as you are. And I mean, I have very little knowledge about this, but I did hear it. And I thought it was extremely wise and insightful. And it's something that I hoped that, you know, we could apply in our own lives. So it's very different, John, I think, here compared to what you describe.
Yeah, I hear differences, I hear similarities. That's part of the reason why I stuck with people from sandy places, hunter-gatherer nomads, because I knew I needed some kind of a constraint of variables. Otherwise, you know, indigenous people vary so widely, you know, even in close proximity to each other, even among bushmen. That story that Matt just told of the treaty around the waterhole was not something that this particular group was aware of that I was with, but it comes from the Kalahari, and it more likely comes from the people whose traditional healers, the ones who trance, they do this trance dance around the fire as one of their healing methods, and that's pretty common throughout the Kalahari. Some of them turn into lions when they dance, and the lion is their main sort of power connection, I guess you could say, and the lion is bringing healing. And so I think that group has a communication relationship with the lion similar to what you described with the Tlingit people. I did learn from a man in his 90s now, his name is Merv Wilkinson, and he's in British Columbia on Vancouver Island in Ladysmith. And he created I think he wrote a book called Wildwood Wisdom or something like that. And he's basically known to the forestry community as a guy who's really pushed really sustainable forestry to a whole nother level, and he has a much more soft and indigenous style to the way he gathers and harvests wood. There's all these universities have studied his methods because he really does take better care of the forest than what's conventional. But his his young years, he spent a lot of time with Tlingit people and a lot of time going up rivers. And he said that whenever this one Tlingit guide he worked with entered into the river and they would have to enter into territory that they hadn't been in before, they always would stop and he would sing a song and then call out to the bear and tell him exactly what he just said, basically. And he told me that that really influenced the way he thought about life. You know, that little gesture showed such respect and humility. It really changed the way, and Merv was probably in his, I think he said he was 19 when he first saw it, but he said it really, he carried that with him the rest of the year and the rest of his life, and it really influenced who he became. So I think those little cultural gestures can be really, really powerful for people and can do a lot of mentoring, if you will, you know, sort of almost like a kind of a mental virus that just gets trapped in your head and gets you to think differently about the way you walk. You know, when no one else is around to talk to you about it, you still remember that story and you still want to practice that kind of sensitivity and respect and that reciprocity that comes out of that kind of thinking. So that I find pretty commonly, you know, and how it's applied, it changes from place to place, but those gestures of humility, respect, and reciprocity are everywhere in indigenous communities that I've been with. They just show up differently in every community.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, I think having read ethnographic accounts of people, indigenous people all around the world, especially hunting and gathering people, as well as other people who don't live entirely by hunting and gathering, but I've never seen an exception to that whole idea of approaching the world with humility and respect, restraint, reciprocity. I've never seen an exception to the idea that the world around us is rich with power and awareness. I've never seen an exception to the idea that human beings are not paramount in the community of living things, and that the proper position of humankind is one of acknowledging that there are much greater things around than we are. And that I think, I just haven't seen an exception to it anywhere in the world. I think it's the fundamentally human way of seeing the world that we live in and the creatures and plants and physical world that we live around. And we're trying this grand experiment of throwing that away. And we have evidence everywhere around us that the experiment isn't working, and that our philosophy of dominating the world and changing it to whatever thing we think it ought to be, and of considering other animals to be a matter of convenience, if they're interfering with us, we can just get rid of them. I don't think it works, and I think that above all is what certainly I sense in what you're saying, that what should be motivating us most deeply is, again, helping other people to you know, introducing them to these things that we as outsiders know very little about, but other people know deeply, introducing them to that and hopefully encouraging our own societies to respect that and to do whatever we can to help assure that these indigenous ways of seeing are not only perpetuated, but, and I think this is a lot of what motivates your own work, that we try to learn them and teach them to others from our own culture and make them a part of this culture that we belong to.
That's absolutely my mission in life, and you just said that very eloquently. Thank you. You know, I think about the book, you know, What the Robin Knows, that we just released through Houghton Mifflin, and the mission of that book was, from the outset, how can we get some, you know, this reciprocal thinking, you know, this intentional sensitivity and respect as a way of walking, literally, you know, in the case of this book, literally, how to walk even in your own yard in a way that will change the way you think about the world, you know? Mm. And I don't come out and say that overtly. People have read the book through and said, now, wait a minute, I can sense there's something in that you're not saying that the book seems to be saying. And is it that if we walk more gently and respect the little birds and learn to befriend them and build relationships with them, They'll tell us about things around us, but doesn't that also help us just to be better people in general? You know, and you know, that was certainly my mission, and is my mission. And I guess more than anything, you know, because I've been, you know, let me just call myself a culture geek. You know, I dive so deeply into this, I think I lose the mainstream pretty quickly just in what I think about. You know, and so I was really trying to find a way to come back from my deep forest experience and actually be able to talk to my neighbors in a way that would help them, because I really feel like our, you know, the modern folks really need this medicine, and I really wanted to find a way to be successful in bringing a message to them that they could relate to even in their own backyard. You know, so my favorite message to them is, you know, you don't need to go into a grandiose wilderness experience with the Bushmen to get this bird language thing. If you're paying a mortgage or if you're paying rent, just go outside your front door and start with the first bird that you see, and let that be something that visits you every day, and visit that bird every day, and get to know that individual as an individual, and see how your conduct affects that being, essentially, and see what kind of feedback you get, and then adjust accordingly. And that's, in a way, that's the essence, you know. And I'm really, really trying to find a way to make it work for someone living in Portland, Oregon, or even Manhattan, you know, or L.A., who may not have anywhere near the opportunities that you and I have had, or that Matt has, and, you know, to really have a rich experience in beautiful wild places. And we'll see if it works or not. I mean, the jury's out. It's just a month old, but people are pretty excited so far, but I'm hoping that it will plant a seed, I guess, that will grow vigorously in their conscience, you know.
Well, so. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying about how much we could learn in our own little yards. And I think the whole idea of urban nature is really fascinating. There's a number of books that have been written about it, and one that comes to mind is called The Cincinnati Arch, and for the life of me I can't think, I remember his first name, John, but there's a number of books going back even back to the 1930s written by people who are trying to call people's attention to the richness of nature even in cities. I think of a book called The Falconer of Central Park, written by this guy who's a British journalist who was assigned for a year or two to be a bureau reporter in New York City. And he decided to see how many species of birds he could see. And he wrote this fabulous book about all the things, human and natural, that he saw in Central Park. Well, your yard and my yard and Matt's yard are a heck of a lot smaller than that, our little tiny patches of ground that have all these amazing things living in them. And I think you make such a great point about, you know, this morning I was sitting at my desk and there was a junco singing on the bird feeder there, and just captivated by the music of this little bird sitting there a couple of feet away. And we have these miracles right in our own yards that are so readily accessible this time of year. Here in Sitka, Alaska, we have thrushes singing in our yards, and orange crown warblers and ruby crown kinglets that say chi 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 tahuzi tahuzi tahuzi. That's the way Koyukon people render the song of the ruby crown kinglet. We've got these amazing things right here, and man, I couldn't agree more that if we just could focus our learning right there, we'd be way ahead.
Right on. Great. Super. Yep, I'm there. And I guess it's the hope, because, you know, I guess a part of what drives this message is that as I travel around from place to place, so many people who are urban dwellers look at me in this really sort of sad, hopeless way. Oh, I guess that leaves us out, you know. And I've just wanted to say, and have said, and continue to say, no, you know, you've got it too, and it's right there. You know, you might have to listen past some traffic noise to hear some of the subtlety, but it's there, you know, and dig in and find it, you know. And I think, you know, we could go a long way with that. And I'm going to try anyway. I'm going to, you know, spend this next year or so in my book tour while the book's in hardback, and just really bring that message to various cities as I move around, and just, you know, see what kind of feedback we get and what starts from that. And who knows? The people of Portland were pretty excited after I left there over the weekend, so hopefully there'll be some harvest on that. I can come back in a year or so to the city and see the same people and see how it landed, you know, no pun intended.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also that I'm sitting here looking across the desk at Matt Goff, and Matt is an incredibly fortunate person. He's lived his whole life in this little town of Sitka, Alaska, and he's in the process of making himself, and has already, in my estimation, made himself an extraordinary naturalist. And most of Matt's, and I'll let him speak for himself, but I think most of your studies of natural history, Matt, have been done on foot here in Sitka, Alaska. And I think, Matt, I think books are a way of planting this seed. And a guy like Matt Goff walking around in his town and learning everything, just absorbing voraciously and energetically everything he can learn about this place, and then sharing it with other people as he does as a citizen of this community, is doing the same work in a really fundamental, really important person-person way. I'm sorry, I've embarrassed you tremendously, Matt. But this, am I right in talking about what your mission is about learning the natural history of our little town?
Well, I would say that's putting it in the friendliest words. The slightly less friendly words is I have a compulsion that I don't know where it came from. and I also have the awareness that if other people have more eyes than I do in combination. So by getting other people to pay attention, I get to see more stuff. So,
right,
so that's the selfish way of looking at it. But yes, the generous way of looking at it is yeah, I'm very interested in natural history here. And even when I travel, I find myself much less interested. It's not that I'm totally uninterested. It's just, I don't have the same, doesn't have, it's not home. And so, I mean, I've worked with John and he's been a mentor for me over the past few years. And, so he's aware of some of this as well, but yeah, it's, you know, the projects that I set up for myself this year's 1,000 Species Project. I may not get to 1,000 species this year, but I'm noticing far more things than I had noticed before, and you know, moths and beetles and, you know, intertidal stuff, but just things that's the moths. You know, I walk around the park and I look at the walls where the lights have been on at night, and the moths land on the walls, and there's an amazing amount of diversity in the patterns and of the moths that are there, and the little beetles, you think of the big ones, but there's so many little beetles. There's like a beetle for every place. And so just starting to get, you know, dig into a little bit past the iceberg of the birds, and then starting to think about how all those things are connected. Things are eating this or using it for homes or various other things. And with the internet being there to, you know, make it so much easier to find out about these things. I found this little spider the other day. I took a picture of it, and there was this little yellow larva of some sort on there. So I posted it, and I'm like, I don't know what this is. And they said, well, it looks like a wasp larva. And you know, somebody else had taken a picture of the same sort of thing. Now, I don't know what species, but so there's this little, I mean, it was a tiny spider and an even smaller larva. And then this wasp will eventually, you know, consume the spider and then go on. And just all this stuff that's, if you just pay attention, it's there. And it's really fascinating. So yeah, I'm interested in getting as many people on board that train as possible. I don't expect other people to be quite as obsessed as I am with the full generality of it. But, you know, everybody has their things. You know, some people it's birds. Some people are really interested in plants. And because I'm interested in all of it around here, it's like I'm happy to talk with anybody about the things that they're interested in. And we all kind of collectively learn more if we share it. So yeah, that's
well,
kind
and
of
I think
great,
that, Matt, I, no, go, go ahead, John.
Lucky to have you there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Matt is a model and an inspiration. And you know, one of the things, and I really want to say this so that listeners on the radio will know about it if they haven't heard about it, is Matt has been instrumental in developing the Sitka Bird Network or web. It's an online presence, and you can go to sitkanature.org. If I got that right, Matt?
Yeah, there's the weblog at sitkanature.org, and there's a sign up for the bird list there if you want to post sightings.
And what the bird list does is it creates a meeting point for people who are interested in birds, and if by following it online you see the names of people from around the community and new names, new people coming into it. And it's another way, along with writing books and speaking and public, forums and stuff like that, but also creating these communities online where you can, like you're saying, Matt, somebody else can show you where to go to see a certain thing, but what the BirdNet does is it shows us all, oh, hey, if I go to such and such place right now, if I go to the lake, Matt had something on there the other day about, what was it, 150... shovelers?
Yeah, somebody saw over 100 shovelers. The most I saw was 50, but the day before that, somebody had seen 100 shovelers. There was a couple of ruddy ducks, which were pretty unusual.
Yeah, right.
A pair of red-throated loons were on the lake a couple days ago, and people share those, and it's interesting that, one of the things that we've talked about in the Village Talk calls that I've been on with John over the last couple of years, one of the things that's come up in that, and it's kind of a group mentoring call thing, but it is the importance of people who go on these nature connection journeys. They get really interested in nature. John said that in his experience, they end up kind of leveling out. They plateau, and there's only so far they can go. And if you really want to keep going, you have to have the community of people that support that. And that helps you go a lot further. It's the people that come back to and you tell your story to, and they encourage and support. They may not know what you're seeing, but they're interested in it, and they hear your story of the day. And without that, it's incredibly difficult to keep moving down that path. And John could certainly speak more to that than I can. But
well, I think you just did a great job. The one thing I would add to it is just that curiosity is infectious, in a really positive way. If I'm very curious about something, and I share that curiosity with a neighbor, they get immediately curious too. That's if they're showing up in the moment. I mean, it's possible that they're not in the moment with me, so they don't let their curiosity come to the surface. But there's a couple people on my street now that regularly swap stories with me just when I'm out walking with my kids, and it's so fun. Just everything that Matt is saying, it's right there. I'm learning about my neighborhood from people who've lived here for 32 years longer than I have, and they're very excited to know that there's a neighbor excited about the things that they're curious about. So they look for me now, and I look for them. So not only does it help us grow as naturalists, but it also just, I think, enriches our lives. It gives us more friends, and we find more like-minded people, and our kids get the benefit of more sort of adopted aunts and uncles that, provide more perspective. So, it's just a win-win for us to come out of the bushes as naturalists and really engage with our communities.
You know what you're saying? I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and Matt's just a great example of that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really important here is, we can characterize ourselves, as we often do, as obsessive nature geeks or whatever. But the truth of it is that it's a fundamentally human thing. And what we're talking about now is about how this helps to make us all part of our human community, and how we, we learn from others, and maybe once in a while we can pass something else along that somebody else hasn't heard yet or whatever. And so this passion for nature is really a passion for our own community, the one that we belong to, that includes our other people as well as all these other incredible creatures that live around us. If there are 50 shovelers in Swan Lake, there are 50 miracles sitting there on the water that we can go down and look at. I mean, a shoveler is such an exquisite creature to look at. And if it's a mallard, if it's one of the most common animals anywhere around us, you take a look at a mallard, and it's mind-boggling how beautiful that creature is. And then if you start adding in the stories that have been shaped around the mallard by Native American people for thousands of years, and then suddenly this little miraculous thing you're looking at becomes this enormous human and natural story.
Nice. Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's just such a pleasure to be a part of that whole sharing of excitement, enthusiasm, and sometimes being able to laugh at our own goof ups and mistakes, and also to take a look and realize that in the scale of things, each of us knows so little that the only way we'll ever know more than a little is by listening to the people who know so much more than we do. And of course, as you start out pointing out right at the beginning, is that that Indigenous people around the world who have been paying attention so acutely for such a long period of time are they can teach us so much, not only about what we live around, but also about how to see it and how to understand it in a much bigger way than the narrow, brilliant, but also narrow perspective of science gives us access to.
Well said. You know, I just was thumbing through Make Prayers to Raven. I've had that book on my shelf for I don't even know how long. But it's been a long, long time since I read it, and I'm re-inspired to read it again. I mean, just realizing in, you know, getting ready to have this conversation with you two today, I just was just reviewing that book again and just remembering what a timeless treasure it is, you know, for anyone who wants insight into the kinds of things that we're talking about that are not just about the information and nature, but also the sort of qualitative energetic pieces that are behind it, you know, the more cultural, spiritual messages that help us be better people and more engaged. That's a fantastic book.
And well, thanks. I mean, I really appreciate that, John. And I do want to say that the quality of the things that we write is only what it reflects is the quality of the people who have been our teachers. And Make Prayers to the Raven is a very small, you know, just a glint of how much Koyukon elders, and I want to say how grateful I am to those people who have been my teachers, and how grateful I am for their patience with my very limited understanding, thinking especially of Catherine Atla, who was possibly the most important teacher in my life, who died a few months ago. That we incur a tremendous debt at the same time that we hope we're giving something back in our own small way for the generosity that's been shown to us by these people.
Yeah, brilliant. I'll echo that and just say that I certainly wouldn't be where I am and able to even be in this conversation were it not for some amazing elders in my life also. And let's just put that collective gratitude out there and to the elders that we know and don't know that carry knowledge and pass it on to us, that we will hopefully pass it on in our way to those who are ahead of us. So,
yeah,
great.
Absolutely. Well said. And I'm again looking at Matt across the way here, and I know that he has been maybe the number one beneficiary of two elders here in Sitka. I mean, elders come from all cultures and backgrounds, and we have a couple of elder women here in Sitka who we've all been great beneficiaries of, and Matt has systematized their decades of observations. Do you want to say something about them, Matt?
Oh, sure. Marge Board and Marla Stadeen. Actually, they were kind of inspiring for me in one respect. When I started talking to Marge and learning, she's in her mid-80s now, when I first was getting to know her, I realized, and around the time I was starting to be more of a birder, I still sort of don't consider myself a birder exactly, but getting more interested in birds and in talking to her, and it seemed like she'd just been birding forever. But she said she didn't start until she was about 55. And I realized that by the time I was the age she was when she started, I would have been birding longer than she had been to that point. And to me, it just seemed like she'd been birding for a long time. And I know other people, Lucy, who's been on the show before, she said it was helpful to hear that, you know, you don't have to be young to start being curious, you know, that and paying attention to these things and getting interested in them. And my hope for the radio show is, you know, I so far in order to make it a little easier on me, I've tended to have people who I know I can talk to stuff about. But in the long run, I'm hoping that it'll become much more about not necessarily what people know, but what they're curious about. Maybe they don't know yet, but what have they seen out there and what are they curious about? And maybe it's just an intuitive sense of that curiosity is contagious thing that John mentioned. But, you know, that to me is what the more people that are just being curious and noticing things because they know somebody is interested, the more that we all get out of it. And that's, that to me is valuable. And so having people that have been paying attention, like Marge and Tadine and keeping records, it's just, it's amazing. I'm kind of a data junkie just by, you know, temperament. I like to play with data. So it's been fabulous for me to have that. But then also to just, you know, that historical perspective, it's easy to forget. It's easy to feel like the present moment is how it always is. And they talk about that in ecology as the shifting baseline of fisheries and so forth. And you read the accounts and you go, well, they were exaggerating back then. And it wasn't like that. Couldn't have been because it's not been like that in our lifetimes. And so each generation knows what they're familiar with and they tend to gauge things based on that. But to have somebody's data, I mean, in a really simple kind of trivial way, is the northern flicker. I think I mentioned that maybe when I did the show with you. And I just, you know, I grew up here and I knew about some birds. I didn't pay a lot of attention to birds, but flickers aren't exactly subtle birds. Mm-hmm. And I noticed them on the lawns when I was going to graduate school at Washington State. And so I saw them there and kind of started to recognize them, got familiar with them. And then the first year I was back here in the fall, I heard something. I go, man, that sounds like a flicker. I mean, they're clear call. I was like, that sounds like a flicker. And so I went out and I looked and sure enough, it was a flicker. And I thought, huh, they must have moved in since I left. I mean, they weren't around here before when I was a kid. Right. And then, you know, a couple years later, I met Marge and I looked and I saw her records. And going all the way back to 1980, there were flickers all the way along. And you know, I just hadn't noticed. And how much, it wasn't like, yeah, I just didn't, nobody pointed it out to me and I didn't have any motivation to notice it. It wasn't like I didn't spend time outside as a kid. I mean, we played around outside all the time. So, but for whatever reason, I just didn't notice it. And that, I mean, I've had several reminders of that sort of thing. It's like, I grew up here and I remember not, or I don't remember noticing these things. And then here they are. And then to find out from somebody who's been around, oh, that's how it always was. You just didn't notice. How much more am I still not noticing, you know? So I'm always a little bit careful to say when I see something, I don't know if it's new or if it's just I'm starting to notice it more. But John's talked about the red tail hawk thing that in a nature connection journey, people and probably bird language especially, people start to notice that there's a certain stage and I don't remember exactly where you've shared it, John, but where they start telling you about all the red tail hawks that are showing up around that have never been around before.
Yeah, there was a young fellow named Andrew. He was 15 and 16 when this took place. I was teaching at a high school in New Jersey, and yeah, he came to my desk one morning and he said, "Mr. Young, there's a. Did you notice all the red-tailed hawks that moved in the area?" And I was like, "Whoa!" I got excited. You know, here in my mind, I'm picturing a sudden increase in them. And so I asked him to please describe where he was seeing them, all these red-tailed hawks, and he described all the pairs that I saw every day on my way to school that I had been seeing for, you know, 3 years I was commuting to that school. And, well, I didn't take anything away from him. I didn't say, "Andrew, you know, they've been there the whole time." I just asked him a lot of questions and encouraged his enthusiasm, but then I scratched my head after that. And that happened more than once with more than one individual, but I came to find out that one of the instructors from our after-school program had taught red-tail hawk just a couple of weeks before Andrew started telling me these things. So, you know, I'm with you on that, Matt. Mm. I think, you know, what else are we missing? And I think we can assume that we're always missing something because I think as humans we have limited capacity to see, know, perceive the entire universe. So we can rest assured that we'll never quite master the full understanding and knowledge of everything in the universe. In our lifetime, so that we can all look forward to a life of learning and discovery and mystery unfolding that, you know, that will never, as far as I'm concerned, it will just never lose its power to amaze me, humble me, and fill me with excitement. And the best part about it is it's just right there. You know, it's free. You know, you don't have to go searching crazy to find something so beneficial. It's not. It's just right there. It's just a matter of having access through inquiry and support of people who share your curiosity and your passion to learn. And I know that that's every one of us. And it's just a matter of kind of breaking the ice and moving, or just strengthening what's already happening, which I really hear, and I'm grateful for that you're interested in supporting there with this radio show, as well as just how you are in your community. Because I know you have been an inspiration to a lot of people that have told me so, and I hope you continue, and both of you, really. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been... It's been fun to do the have this conversation with you both. Like I say, I figured it'd be a conversation I was interested in listening to. So hopefully other people find it interesting as well. And you know, there is always more stuff to look at out there. And I know that some people are intimidated by that. In the Kamana program, the home study naturalist course that you developed, I think it's referred to as the wall of green when you get into plants, and a lot of people are just super intimidated because they all, you know, they feel like they look the same. I've heard about people talk about birds that way. Actually, I just was talking to somebody today, and they're like, you can tell birds apart by their songs? No way. Mm-hmm. And that's just how people feel. And so, you know, What the Robin Knows really emphasizes, you know, like you said before, get to know the one bird in your yard that you see every day. Mm. And what I found really helpful for me is, well, I like to take pictures, but the other thing is that I find that I get to know the stuff that is the most usual that I see, and then I start to notice differences. And so you start with just the small group of things, and it slowly expands out as you notice differences. And so that's, you know, paying attention and then looking at the differences seems to be a way to be a little less intimidated by all the stuff that is out there. And along the way, you'll see lots of interesting things, and it's just interesting for its own sake. Even if you can't put a name on it, you know, the fact that you saw it is interesting in and of itself. And, you know, you can always put a name on it. It's just the little brown beach beetle with stripes, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. It doesn't have to have a scientific name. And so that's one of the things that I think is interesting also, is just this shared, once you start to share this with people, you have this shared language of, you know, people that I've done things with, I can describe, oh, where the plant is. And, you know, if I want to say where something is in Totem Park, I say it's where the good Euro is growing, and they'll know where that is because it's an unusual plant for around here, and it's there. And there's that sort of shared connection with each other and the place where you live. And I find that really compelling, I guess, and maybe it is just part of the human the way humans are meant to be, and unfortunately in many cases aren't these days, and so maybe that's why it's compelling to me to be that way. But yeah,
great.
Yeah,
well, thanks both of you for this really rich conversation. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks both for being on here. I will edit this for the radio on Sunday, but I'll just post the whole thing on my website. So, John, you said other people would probably be interested in this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. People will be really excited about this.
So, yeah.
I'll send it out.
You're well-known in some places. So.
Yeah, you are. I was talking to a professor at the University of Vermont this morning, Richard, and mentioned that I was going to be on this call with you, and he was like, wow, Richard Nelson? Make Prayers to Raven? I said, yeah. He says, oh, wow, that's going to be amazing. Send me the link, you know, so, you know, there people know you and respect you, and I know the professor that assigned the book to us has required reading really respected you, and then we all came to respect you, and, you know, for a very long time, so I was excited to have this opportunity.
Well, it's great to be a part of the crew, you know, this clan of people who have so much in common. And, you know, I've always thought about people who write about the natural world, and there's quite a community of them, you know, and that the great thing about them, in my estimation, has always been that they're working in service to their subject, not in service to themselves. And And I used to spend a lot of time traveling around with these nature writers, and one of the things that just struck me so powerfully was how much energy they devoted to celebrating each other's work and how little they devoted to celebrating themselves. And I felt it was because we were all joined together by the fact that we're celebrating something so much bigger and so much more important than we are.
Well said. Yeah, great, great point. Yeah.
And I guess I'll just mention here also, Richard knows, the reason he was speaking to a professor at the University of Vermont is they're working on a graduate program there in a master's degree in essentially nature connection. How to get, I mean, John can give you the technical lingo a little better than I can for sure, but John's working on a PhD there, and then they're also starting this master's program. Did they come up with the formal name for sure yet, or?
Yeah, you know, the name has changed, you know, many times, not because of me. But the most recent, most stable name so far is Transformative Ecosocial Leadership. And it more or less recognizes that when people achieve a critical mass of connection with the natural world, you know, this whole reciprocity conversation really takes root. It literally transforms the individual and brings them to that place of humility and service to the larger that you just referred to, Richard. So my job in that is the person who's helping to develop the process by which we can, I'm not going to say guarantee, but, you know, assure with pretty good confidence that a person who goes on a journey will receive the benefit of that transformation. So, you know, my job is the nature connection component, and then the leadership department at the university and sustainability will sort of harvest on the moment of transformation and help people find a path that befits them. You know, so it's a low residency program for mid-career professionals, so hoping to find stakeholders in the world who want to have a larger impact in, with their life energy, basically. So we'll see where it goes, but it's, you know, it's getting a lot of excitement on the faculty and among the graduate staff and the graduate students themselves. And we're looking to launch in the fall of 2013, but you know how those things go, I'm sure.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. How exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited to work on it. It's been one of the most exciting things I've worked on yet in my life. It's also causing me to have to transform too, which is fun. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, it's really been great to talk with both of you guys. Just what a privilege. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, and I hope we can have another one someday.
That sounds excellent.
That'd be fun by my standards, and maybe if you ever get up here, John, maybe Richard will be in town, and you can get together.
That'd be great. That would be great.
Talk over a beer or something.
Come and visit.
Well, I'll tell you what, that just sweetens the pot, Matt. So we'll just keep working on that picture.
All right, sounds good.
Let's plan it so Richard is in town.
Yeah. Well, he does like to travel on occasion. Sometimes up north, and sometimes way south, down to Miles' country.
Right on. Okay.
All right.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, all right. You too. Thanks. Summer. Thanks so much. We'll see ya.
Yeah. Thank you all. Take
see ya.
Care.
Bye.